Our next speaker is from Monsanto. Ty Whitten is going to be discussing usage and availability of off-patent germplasm and traits, regulatory considerations.
So I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I thank the society and all the folks that have spoke. For some of you, this is really nice. For those of you who've been in the field and done field research or plant breeding or whatnot, thinking about the regulatory environment and where we are for patentability and who owns what and what can you do in the field is not just a straightforward process for me. So I appreciate the colleagues here to set us up. For me, it's nice to hear things three times, so maybe I'll be the third time and repeating a few actions here. But, you know, again, this is not a straightforward process. I think from a U.S. perspective, it definitely is. But from a commodity base in agriculture, we don't deal only with the U.S. It moves globally, and I think we'll see that as we move forward. So a couple of the slides here I think we've seen, we look at them a little differently. Obviously, you stated earlier that the U.S. is governed the regulatory framework through three agencies, the USDA, FDA, and EPA. And the distinction here is obviously all plants that are genetically engineered go through a USDA approval process. And within that, the consultation is expected within the FDA. And obviously, if you have a PIP, a plant-incorporated protectant, such as a BT technology, whatnot, it becomes a pesticide, and so it's regulated differently with an additional piece of oversight on that regulatory environment. In here, I'd like to make a note that I think they have talked very readily about some of these things being time-limited or not time-limited for FDA and USDA specifically. EPA is a time-limited registration. It has some recertification that's required. The other piece, it has mandatory reporting yearly, in most cases, about what's going on in the field level. I'll talk a little bit about that on the next slide. The other distinction from the EPA perspective, it does provide specific data protection. I believe, Gene, you talked about this early on. It's initially 10 years and then has an additional 5 years that you have opportunity there, and there's compensation associated with that. And so, you know, within that, that are some of the distinctions that we have here. Again, once the product is deregulated, product and its progeny is for the life in the U.S. perspective, but from the EPA, that registration must be maintained by an individual or person for it to continue. From a USDA perspective, as we look at the regulations that limit this availability to cultivate, it covers all GE crop products. And once the regulatory notifications or information has been given, and potentially if the product has become deregulated, it will have no restrictions on that cultivation and movement within the United States. Skip down, the consultation with FDA covers, again, all food and feed. The specific item here that's unique is the plant incorporated protectants, or PIPs. They're registered as a pesticide, and they do have to have some other governing authority. They're always regulated, not only from a federal level, but obviously at a state level as well. So there's not only a federal registration, there's state registrations that go along with this. So the sale and distribution requires this registration for an approved label for the use pattern, and it has limitations for the use of it. There's also cultivation restrictions in many cases. There are IRM management programs that are associated with it, as well as grower agreements, other reporting mechanisms, knowing the basis for this cultivation. So it, from a PIP perspective, the EPA has much oversight from the U.S. perspective. With that, we look at international regulations. So I think we've covered very readily where we are from a U.S. perspective and how we govern. I think the implication here, this is pulled from the FAO stat, an example of corn, talking about global movement. It's produced in the U.S., but if you look, it goes globally. So that commodity, regardless of its ability to have freedom to operate within the borders of the United States for cultivation and sale, that commodity moves globally. So with that, cultivated GE crops produce globally traded commodities. In this case, a lot of times it's grain or the byproducts or fractions of that, but they're regulated outside the U.S. And the key here is, if we look at this map for countries with GE crop regulatory systems, if you notice in blue, there's countries that actually cultivate today GE crops. But there's only 36 countries granting approvals today for import. However, there's 161 countries that are participating in a biosafety protocol. So we have, basically, when you look at importing differences, about 125 or so countries that on any given day could enact and have some kind of provision for biosafety protocol in action for regulatory activity to allow import of grain or commodity into country. So right now we're dealing with 36, but as the world becomes, as biotechnology or genetic engineering becomes outside of its infancy, becomes mature technology, we see more movement globally in terms of regulatory status and governance as we look outside the U.S. borders. So I think that, you know, that's a key here to think about is just because a commodity moves into your program, even understanding of what low-level presence is within a breeding action or how that enters the commodity stream, I think is very important on the implications it may have to global trade and governance. So from an international overview, when we look at obtaining a worldwide approvals, this is complex. We just saw on the previous slide, there's 36 countries to date that deal with that recognize some kind of import approval process of a commodity. So they're all unique. There's not one that's standard versus the other. Some require other documentation and whatnot, and some of these can take up to 10 years for the process to happen. So you could have a deregulation condition in the United States for cultivation, but you may not be able to move that grain globally. I think that's been some of our struggles from an industry perspective to bring new traits to market is making sure we do have freedom to operate so we do not disrupt trade or grain movement as we talk about a global economy. And so there's also distinct approvals for import versus in-country cultivation. We'll talk about that again. I think we mentioned that commercial breeding and or research is not covered on most import approvals of a commodity. So when we're talking about PVP and the subject matter today is we're talking about small movements of varieties or inbreds going to a country to move germplasm and transfer and improve those breeding stocks. It may not be covered or it may not be allowed under the provisions within that country, and that is a distinction that we need to understand. Also, in maintaining those approvals, globally they're not for life of the product as in USDA here within the United States. Those renewals are required in most countries, and they're varying time limits depending on where you're at. They could be a 3-year renewal up to a 10-year renewal. Also, as we look at countries changing and as they evolve, as their systems become out of move from infancy to being more mature, we also see changes in the biosafety provisions and laws. New agencies coming on board, countries having policy shifts. There's also other things that influence their policy and laws there. So again, we also see that new markets may emerge. So as we understand grain movement in corn, let's say corn doesn't go to some country. There's no commodity movement. We have no trade. Well, the need to seek that import approval may not be necessary. However, commodity shifts, needs shift. Once that grain starts moving into that country, import approval must be sought to allow for free trade. So again, this is an evergreen process that we're seeing multiple changes happening. And again, that was pointed out earlier, I believe, Bernice, that you said it to start out with, is that once genetically engineered events are stacked by breeding, I may have 2 or 3 or 4 events that are approved in all countries. But once I start to combine those through traditional breeding methods, they're treated as a unique trait or a unique event for most of those countries. In the United States, we are fortunate that it does not recognize that. But all of the countries primarily recognize those as unique registrations and unique approvals that need to be maintained. So as we look at this, you know, as a whole, when we're talking about science-based assessments, to talk about safety of the product, toxicological profiles, what's going on, is it safe for food and feed? Most countries adhere to the tenets of the OECD Codex guidance documents for scientific risk assessment. But again, political and socioeconomic changes can influence this regulatory approval process. So again, they're not well-defined, they're unpredictable, and, you know, intense advocacy can change on where we're at. I think we've seen some examples in that over the last 5 years globally where commodities have shifted, where they've had good scientific review and approval process, but once the political arm gets involved, it can change where that movement is. Again, the renewals and new submissions or reauthorization may be required and may often require new data. So an example here is we look at globally, Korea has had a change within their regulatory system. They went from basically 2 primary agencies to an additional 3 consulting agencies, which results in 5 agencies for a review process. And so that has added new processes involved and new data requirements as we look at a global movement. And again, the product is still continually regulated, and it's not for a life renewal or lifetime approval. It must be renewed. So as we look at this, when we talk about gene discovery, the early part of the biotech process or genetic engineering process, all the way to product discontinuation, regulatory control extends over every process here, whether it's field testing in the United States, governed by notifications or permits, or EUPs within the EPA. This happens globally as well. Again, we talked about that it's important to understand the difference between an import approval versus cultivation for research purposes or commodity sale, et cetera. And so it's governed through the entire life of the process. And so stewardship, control practices within a breeding organization, then once you've introduced a genetically engineered trait into that program, the life of that and transfer of that within that breeding program or commercial program is important to test for that. Because as we look through, we may end up in a product discontinuation globally to where it has some allowances for that product to move out of the market. But once it has, if those renewals have not been maintained after some time period or recognition within that government and then reintroduced unintentionally, could have implications to trade there as well. So appropriate stewardship measurements are important. I think, Bernice, you talked about that in the Accord, that understanding what that looks like and how a small body, a public institution or whatnot, can operate under here to recognize the diversity we have globally is really important. So from a take-home message, when we look at, from the U.S., I think the distinction here is PIP versus non-PIPs that we understand. Once we have a PIP or a pesticide within the plant, it's always regulated with the United States. And there are some governances that are required to do that for the life of that product within the United States if it's registered within the EPA. Outside the U.S., genetically engineered traits are highly regulated. There is no condition to where they're unconditionally available for the life of a product. They will always remain regulated in some form or fashion. Seed-containing GE traits have limitations regarding the ability to plant or cultivate in global areas. So again, the distinction between an import approval versus a cultivation or research approval should be very clear. Also, the regulatory terms, conditions, requirements remain valid regardless of the intellectual property status of the GE trait, domestically for PIPs and international in all products. So irrespective of what intellectual property is attached to this, or PVP, there's still governance that's required from a regulatory and biosafety provision in the U.S. and globally. At the bottom, I also have a plug here for bio-trade status. This is a volunteer place where most industry is going to put all the approvals for import and or cultivation of all current biotech traits that are commercially available. There's a few resources additionally out there, but again, this you can get through this through the bio web page that Bernice had up there as well. But again, this is an example where we're trying to inform and communicate where we stand globally on freedom to operate. With that, that's a quick summary of where we stand and the implications where we are globally. I'll answer any questions. Again, thank you all for the opportunity. The question was, what patents will roll off first for Monsanto? I think in terms of what we're talking about today, the implications would be Bolgard cotton. Now, that's not the first product to roll off patent, but it's one that has different regulatory environments from a PIP perspective within the United States. Yes, sir.
Once it goes off the patent, my understanding is now I can use this trait and I don't have to pay royalties on it. Is that still true?
So, again, if there was a single patent, yeah, once it's off trait, once it's off patent, you have ability to offer that and use that. Now, there may be more than one patent or utility patent associated, as we talked about earlier. But once that's available and once those have expired, yes, so you have freedom to operate there from that perspective. But you may not have freedom to cultivate it or use it within the U.S. or globally. There may be those restrictions from a regulatory perspective outside of what I need to recoup or monetary basis to that provider that originally had that patent. So that was the distinction here, is irrespective of patents or regulatory oversight for that product, potentially.
Is this what we've been talking about? going to be any product registration requirements?
So, again, from a Roundup Ready crop perspective, again, there is no governance from the EPA on a herbicide-tolerant crop. It's only on the herbicide or pesticide that you have. So, no, sir.
Okay. So we really haven't discussed stewardship issues associated with Roundup Ready.
So from a U.S., I would say the distinction here when we're talking about a herbicide tolerance or something like that is the distinction from ability to cultivate or use in the U.S. versus globally. And again, the global perspective is it doesn't recognize the difference between PIPs or non-PIPs. It is governing regulatory oversight. Now, there may be other rules and regulations for understanding insect-resistant management and practices given the product. And again, globally, they look at it on a product basis, not distinctions like in the U.S. The question was on Roundup Ready. Is there any mandatory stewardship or controlling factions for the use of Roundup Ready technology or other herbicide technology within the U.S.? And no, there's not. Once it's deregulated by the United States Department of Agriculture, there would be no regulations on a herbicide-tolerant trait unless there happened to be some provision that changed the current conditions for which that registration was obtained. That provision still always resides that the federal agencies have opportunity to govern if something significantly changed in the environment. But to date, there has not been. Yes, ma'am. Sorry, Marcia. I didn't see. Correct. So, thank you, Marcia. Again, the distinction here is, regardless of the trait on where we stand for the United States, herbicide tolerance versus PIPs or BTs or anything else, you don't have the freedom to operate or move, cultivate, import globally just because you would that distinction within the United States. So that was the take-home message from here, is that internationally, it's a different ballgame. Yes, sir. That's a great question, Bernice. So is the U.S. government engaging to understand basically free trade and movement of commodity as we look at our global colleagues? And I'll punt to our Asta to make a comment. Bernice, come up.
Well, and this is a point that we've really pressed home with our government, and that, in a sense, this may provide us an opportunity here, you know, because this is really, like I said, intellectual property, regulatory requirements kind of meeting head on in a sense, and what we've really pressed with the U.S. government is kind of three things. One, let's start having some rationality in the system. I mean, if you've got a trait that's been cultivated, you know, for 20 years, 25 years, been approved in, you know, any number of countries. We have a history of safe use for that particular trait. And at what point, you know, do we stop re-regulating it every 10 years or 5 years or have to get a new, you know, regulatory authorization for it? That's one thing. The second point is, you know, acknowledging that we're always, you know, as long as we have this international framework, we're going to have asynchronous approvals. And so how do you deal with that globally? And so really trying to focus on low-level presence policies, both from a food and feed perspective and from a cultivation perspective as well. And then thirdly, you know, we really think that there's some opportunity here in that there are a number of different countries, Brazil, for example, Argentina is another one, that it's time for the U.S. government to start looking at partners here. You know, we no longer have to go it alone. There's other countries that really now see and have a real stake in the technology, and we would like to see them making those, utilizing those partnerships to work towards a more rational global system.
Bob?
I would observe that in the end, the fundamentals will always win. You're really in a situation right now where we are the player in the world. It's ourselves and Brazil are the player in the soybean. There's five players in the meat, all of which, of course, wheat isn't transgenic. Basically, grain crops in general are transgenic. If you want to buy grain, it's transgenic. You know, see anybody's synopsis of where transgenic crops are. So, I mean, basically, you know, 20 years from now, I mean, I realize we have to go through all of this. This is an issue that policy should be addressing with OECD, clearly, because it's going to be an impediment. There are going to be people that just can't buy grain at a reasonable price if it continues this way. 20 years from now, we won't be asking about this, because basically the non-PIP traits will be obvious and they'll be there. It's coming. Start now. Agree with everything you want. It will come. By the time your crops are ready, it'll be there. If you breed it, then we'll buy it.
Any other questions or any other comments? So I'm assuming, Bob, real quick, for me, you're going to go on a global whirlwind tour. If you would you start in Asia and work on that? I appreciate it. So again, I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you all very much.
Yeah. All right, thank you. All right, thanks so much, Ty. We're going to...